Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The Sustainable Forest Management Network is well known for its ability to draw strong partners from the industrial and conservation communities. The network has also supported the research of hundreds of graduate students who are making a difference to how we manage our forests in Canada. Some of these incredible people had a chance to talk about their work and the Sustainable Forest Management Network at the recent Canadian Science Writers Association conference in Jasper. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The recent Canadian Science Writers Association conference in Jasper was an opportunity for many of Alberta's research initiatives to showcase their work before an audience that could spread the news about what they're doing. The Sustainable Forest Management Network put on a strong showing, and one of the people I spoke with was Gary Stewart, the regional manager for boreal conservation programs with Ducks Unlimited Canada. Ducks Unlimited has been a partner with the Sustainable Forest Management Network for several years.
Well, we very deliberately joined the network about 5 years ago because a couple of main reasons. We're a science-based conservation company, so science really guides all of our work. And when we moved into boreal conservation, basically looking at the need for conservation on crown lands in the boreal forest, we knew that we needed to get up to speed very quickly and to start associating ourselves with science and scientists that were busy looking at this large forest system. So the network was an obvious choice for us to join.
Has there been specific research that you've been involved with them?
Yes, there has. Our core business is water and wetlands, and that's one of the key themes of the network. It's an area that I think needs more attention. Certainly when we started with the network several years ago, there were some good research projects. We really wanted to focus on the boreal plain and the western boreal forest where most of the industrial activity is occurring, and that's an area where basic understanding of hydrology, the role of wetlands, watershed health was really just beginning to emerge. So we've been very strategic in partnering with Dr. Kevin DeVito. He's associated with a number of other PIs looking at broad-based process work, hydrology work in the forest, and it's been a very good relationship for us.
Any results from that yet?
Yes, the results are good. The science has been going on for a number of years. We're just in the second phase of it. Some very interesting things that we never knew before. There's a lot of peatlands in the western boreal forest and no open water in most of those peatland areas. And so they're pretty much dismissed as habitat for waterfowl and other water birds. But what we're finding out is they are incredibly important for sustaining watershed health, water quality, water supply. They store water, they store nutrients, they transfer it across the boreal plain, often at great distances. They're very susceptible to disturbance, roads. Kevin DeVito calls them actually the green creeks of the forest. So it's an area that needs special attention when you're looking at sustainable forest management, and one that we're working with industry partners there now to apply some of this research in an operational sense to avoid and make sure that peatlands, riparian areas, water areas are protected.
How would you apply that?
Well, we're still working on that science. It could mean the difference between putting five culverts across a fen instead of one or a bridge. It could mean totally avoiding some really sensitive areas. We think some of the highest conservation value forest areas in the boreal plain are actually water-based, source waters, first-order watersheds, springs. There's a lot of water that's not only moving on the surface and through these peatlands, but also shallowly under the ground. And it's a very complex system. And in order for us to really help industry develop better practices to sustain these ecological functions, we need to understand the system very well and then start applying some of these better practices.
Is this work then going to apply to the Northern Boreal Program that you have?
Yes, we're operationalizing that science. The other thing I should add is that internally we've really enhanced our satellite mapping, and we can now map 17 different wetland classes, including all the peatlands and all the wooded peatlands. So just having an understanding at the landscape level and defining real watersheds in this very flat forest is very important. Combining that with the science, then getting progressive industry partners like ALPAC. We've just expanded it beyond ALPAC to Louisiana Pacific in northern Manitoba, and next year we'll probably be looking at Canfor up in northeastern British Columbia. So we're looking at applying the science and the practices broadly across the West.
You're here today to speak to a group of science writers at the Canadian Science Writers Association. What's the message you want to get across to them?
Well, they assigned me the topic, which is Canada's boreal forest, why should we conserve it? And I guess the key message is one of that Canada has a unique opportunity to apply science and traditional knowledge in a collaborative teamwork approach to conserve all of the boreal forest through a combination of large protected areas and world-leading sustainable development. And that will be my message.
Thank you very much, Gary.
You're welcome.
That was Gary Stewart, Regional Manager of Boreal Conservation Programs with Ducks Unlimited Canada. He was speaking at the recent Canadian Science Writers Association conference. You can't have a science conference without poster displays, and at the Canadian Science Writers Association conference in Jasper, the Sustainable Forest Management Network helped four of its young researchers bring their work to the attention of the science reporters there. Eric Nielsen is a master's student in forestry and environmental management at the University of New Brunswick. His poster dealt with research related to carbon sequestration in the forest.
The problem I'm addressing is that through global warming and the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the development of the Kyoto Protocol, there may be a necessity for forest managers to report on the carbon exchanges on their land bases.
Now, is this a difficult problem, or is this something that you really have to come up with the ways they're going to do this?
It's a fairly complex problem to figure out how much carbon is coming in and out of the landscape. I'm working with about a 400,000 hectare land base, and to kind of simulate how much photosynthesis is going on that land base is quite a sizable task.
Well, you're talking about carbon sequestration, but how do you even know how much carbon is out there and how it's being exchanged?
Well, what forest managers know now is they know how much volume they have on their land base due to that's what they sell at the mills and whatnot. So if you know how much volume there is on the land base, then you can get a general sense of how much carbon there is through field survey data, and then weighing trees and figuring out kind of how much biomass to volume there is. So once you know how much volume there is, and through the modeling techniques developed by the Canadian Forest Service in Victoria, they've developed a model that will simulate carbon amounts based on volume.
Does it matter if the trees are older or younger in terms of how much carbon they have?
Generally, the older the tree is, the more carbon there is. So a tree is roughly 50% carbon, so obviously the larger it is and the older it is, the more it weighs and the more carbon it will contain. So on the landscape level, you're looking for older, kind of larger, more volume stands, which will have more carbon.
What have you done?
What have I done? I've taken original, kind of the run-of-the-mill forest management plans where they already know how much volume they have, and then I've simulated how much carbon they're going to have on their land base and then integrated it into their forest management plans so that they can have a reactive model of if they choose this harvesting schedule, this harvesting scenario, what is its impact on carbon in the future and now.
So as a forest planner, what would that do for me?
Well, firstly, there may be a necessity through the Kyoto Protocol for forest managers to report how much carbon is going in and out of their land base. And so, historically, they would have no idea of knowing. They know how much volume is going out there, but they didn't really know how much carbon there is. So with my techniques, I've created a fairly easy way for forest managers to report their carbon stock changes on their landscapes, which they may be required to do anyway. So I've given this forest company, I guess, a first step in reporting their carbon, I guess, balance on their landscape.
As forest planners become more concerned about carbon and carbon sequestration, is this going to change the way they actually manage the trees?
There is a definite potential for change in the forest management regime, especially in New Brunswick, where historically there has been a focus on spruce, fir, and jack pine pulp volume. And my results have kind of suggested that if you're looking to kind of increase the forest carbon stocks, then you need to leave more areas of hardwood out there and maybe switch your management to thinking of more hardwood stand types. So maybe a multi-age selection harvesting system versus a flat-out clear-cut spruce fir plantation type of management, where has kind of been the historical pattern in New Brunswick. So I think there is potential for change in forest management.
Thank you very much, Eric.
Well, thank you.
That was Eric Nielsen, a master's student from the University of New Brunswick. He's researching carbon sequestration for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Piyangi Jayasinghe is a young scientist from Sri Lanka. She came to the University of British Columbia to do a master's degree in forestry. Her poster explained the research she was conducting on whether forest certification programs are having any impact on the wood used by small manufacturers.
I did a Canadian-wide mail survey and asked evaluated manufacturers, do you use certified wood raw materials in your production? And what I found out was 64% of the manufacturing sector, they had no interest in forest certification, or 50% of them had no idea what certification is. So, and one of the reasons that they said that they are not interested is that they don't have a demand for it from their customers.
So where does that lead you then in terms of your research project?
Right, that's the importance of my research, I think. But this is the question that I would like to propose from this research, is that forest certification on Canadian land is increasing exponentially. It's mostly motivated by NGOs and big, large-scale harvesting companies and big retailers like IKEA or Home Depot. And they, for them, it doesn't really matter whether consumers really actually care about forest certification or not, because I think for them, forest certification would make a good case for them if they adopt forest certification, or they can't operate otherwise because they would have a lot of NGO pressure. But when it comes down along the forest product supply chain up to value-added manufacturers and end consumers, nobody cares about it. And there's this huge, huge group of people have no idea about forest certification, and they don't, because of that, they don't care. Or maybe there's no connection, I didn't go to find it. But I think they don't know, and that's why they don't care. So the question is, where forest certification is a market mechanism to address sustainable forest management, but certification is not out there in the market.
Does it mean then that we've put the cart before the horse?
Well, I think for forest certification to work, at least a slight demand is good enough. It would work, but it won't make huge impact unless all the stakeholders involved in forest certification actually really embrace the idea. So the consumers don't know. The general public is a big stakeholder, but they don't know. So I don't know whether it's putting the cart before the horse, because no matter how you put the cart, it will work in forest certification, because it's a market mechanism. Even with a slight demand, it would work. But it's just that it won't give any impact. And the other thing is, forest certification now, if it's continued to be motivated by NGOs and other big, large-scale companies, it will prevail for a long time. But for small manufacturing companies, like value-added manufacturing companies, they have a huge potential to gain market benefits, but because it's not going out there, they don't. There's no use for them. So it's more like NGOs and forest certification agencies. Seems like they have forgotten this small. It's a huge sector made of small manufacturers. So probably they don't care about them because certification could work if it is funded by other large-scale companies.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you, too.
That was Piyenge Jayasinghe, a master's student in forestry at the University of British Columbia. Another presenter in the poster display was Brock Simons. Brock is also a master's student in forestry at UBC. His poster was titled Habitat Suitability Modeling, Pros, Cons, Methods, and Mule Deer.
Well, what I dove into this project originally for is because I have a firm belief that humans and wildlife can live in some sort of harmony together, but it just takes a lot more care and thought in the way that we make our land use decisions. And one of the more important tools, it seems, for addressing wildlife needs is habitat suitability modeling. So I approached habitat suitability modeling, trying to figure out basically the best way to go about it. And there are a couple of main approaches. One is qualitative modeling, where you take a bunch of expert knowledge, either through literature or opinions, and form rough approximations of 0 to 1. And we know if you have this situation, there's no animals. If you have this situation, there's plenty of animals, and then they just basically draw a straight line through it, so it's incredibly rough. Or you develop a mathematical relationship based on actual data, and that is generally the more precise way to do it, and it's really complicated, and I got lost in my entire master's just figuring out how to do that. So that's basically what my poster describes, is how to really dive into the mathematical side of it, get those relationships, which can then, once you have that, that's the foundation for everything, and then they can be plugged into a whole lot of readily available stand and landscape management computer simulation programs.
Well, before you can even run the model and come up with an answer, you have to have data that you plug into it. So where is the data coming from?
That's right. Well, in this case, I use data from a 10-year study in the interior of British Columbia by a man named Dr. Tom Sullivan. And what he did is he had various young lodgepole pine stands that he thinned, pruned, and fertilized at different densities, and then measured the wildlife response to those stand densities. So I took all that data and used that as the foundation.
So your title is Habitat Suitability Modeling, Pros, Cons, Methods, and Mule Deer. What are the pros and cons?
All right. Well, there are a number of pros, and they're pretty convincing. Whenever there's a species that has strong relationships between habitat and its own presence and abundance, then it's a very reliable method. Often, that's also at the same time a con, is when there's a species that doesn't have very strong connections to measurable habitat features, then we tend to it tends to not be very useful. Often, presence and abundance is affected by things other than habitat, such as history, what happened in the past, weather, disease, humans chasing them down and shooting them. These are things that are not necessarily closely tied to habitat. So it's a pro when it is tied to habitat, and a con when it's not. Another nice thing about habitat suitability modeling is that it allows the investigation of management alternatives in a careful, process-oriented way that wouldn't be possible otherwise. Managers need some sort of way to predict what the repercussions of their decisions will be, and again, they can go and ask experts. But it's better to be able to lay out all the assumptions on the table and be able to pick them apart. And experimentation, although that'd obviously be ideal in an ideal situation, a lot of times the questions that managers are asking involve scale of space and over periods of time that make experimentation completely impractical. It's just not possible.
What part did mule deer play in this?
Mule deer were simply a the essence of any sort of management question is always a wildlife of management concern. Some species do just fine when humans are around, and you don't really have to be concerned about them. But those that seem to respond poorly are those that managers need to take special care in paying attention to in their management plans, and mule deer are one of them. It seems that although this may not be necessarily always the reason for population declines in mule deer have a requirement for winter range that is not always very conducive to forestry. Mule deer need, in general, in a mild winter it's not a concern, but in periods of very deep snow, mule deer expend huge amounts of energy trying to move through the snow. It's difficult to get down to their forage. So what they need is a pretty heavy canopy in order to give interception from snow, but also a patchy canopy that'll have some open patches that allow them to get to forage. Although some snow will get in the open patches, more importantly, light will as well. Whereas if you just had a young, dense stand, you'll get decent interception from snow, but it's hard to move through it because the stems are all very close together, and no light will get through, so there won't be any undergrowth, which of course is what deer eat. So what they need is old growth stands, and that's of course what foresters like to put into their mill. So it requires special management attention in order to make sure that some winter range is retained on the landscape. The whole purpose of this, the experiment that I got my data from to begin with, was to see if old growth attributes could be stimulated in young stands by careful management. And so that's why mule deer were of interest and why I ended up using that particular data set.
What's the bottom line then on your poster and your research?
The bottom line, I suppose, is that habitat suitability modeling is important and useful, but in order to do it properly requires an incredible amount of detail and rigor. I think that's basically what it comes down to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Brock Simons, a master's student in forestry at the University of British Columbia. Kinga Uto is a graduate student in the Department of Rural Economy at the University of Alberta. With her poster, Kinga outlined the research she did on Aboriginal economic development.
We have a research partner. It's the Heart Lake First Nation in northeastern Alberta, and they are interested in resort development, specifically highlighting some of the cultural elements of their community. And they were hoping to capitalize on this as a unique market niche. And we had this idea to do a feasibility study to examine demand for cultural elements of camping at campgrounds.
Well, what might be some of those cultural aspects that you could incorporate into that?
Well, some of the things that they highlighted were, of course, the accommodations. They wanted to put up some teepees, cabins, not as much an Aboriginal theme, but nonetheless, sort of a frontier type of accommodation. And so accommodations, teepee, a cultural circle, where they would do some interpretive activities, and as well as interpretation in a wider context, taking people on tours in boats or on trails and explaining some of the heritage that is part of their community.
So what did you do to gather your information?
My task involved going to campgrounds in northeastern Alberta. I picked about 6 campgrounds and interviewing people there. Well, there were two parts of the project. One was an initial interview to screen people, and then people who expressed interest in a take-home survey, then I would mail them a survey at home and just to find out their demand for these services.
What did you find out?
Well, our key result was that people are actually, at least in northeastern Alberta, camping market is not interested in cultural services at campgrounds to the extent that they're not willing to pay a premium for these services. This is supported by the results of the best-worst experiment, which showed that the greatest motivation for camping is to spend time with family and friends and to just relax. And people were least motivated by learning, by intellectually motivated activities. So,
okay. Anything else?
Yeah. Two other findings, actually. People are interested in some very basic attributes of camping, namely fishing opportunities, beaches, and highly serviced camping facilities. And this is also supported by the fact that many of the respondents had very expensive RVs and RV-type accommodations, and it's obviously a demographic that likes to live in comfort and to camp in comfort. So that was one finding. And then the other finding, economically related, I suppose, is that given the attributes that this campground, the First Nation campground, would have, they can expect a good share of the region's camping market.
Well, I'm just looking at some of the information you have on your poster, and like here it says, if you don't have a beach at your campground, you're not going to make any money.
Yeah, and that was actually a very clear finding that beaches are the number one attractor, because I suppose many people are families. Many of the people that go camping are families with small children, and they're looking for a way to entertain their children and to have a relaxing time. And I guess beaches are the hit with everybody, and fishing and private campgrounds. I guess it's all the pretty basic stuff, but the fact that we could determine the revenues lost as a result of not providing these things was an interesting result. So
you talked about campers, and they generally have young children, but lots of tourists are older. How do they fit into this market?
Yeah, actually, that was an interesting finding, that there is an exception to the rule that many people aren't interested in culture, and that is that people without dependents actually are. We can't quite tease out who these people are, because it's not necessarily older folks. So I was thinking perhaps it's the baby boomers of our generation who, having no children to look after, but are still interested in meaningful activities to occupy their time. So, and the one exception to the best-worst experiment, which was to examine the motivations of people to go camping, we found that, again, people without dependents, and here the older people that we surveyed did have different preferences. They were more interested in exploring different places than spending time with family and friends.
When you wrapped it all up then gave this back to the people who are looking for using their cultural heritage as a tourist attraction, how did they react?
Well, they were not terribly surprised that there was not a market domestically for cultural services. In fact, they relayed to us that they were expecting an international market for this type of thing. And the market in Canada for cultural services is primarily from the international arena. Japan, Germany, the UK, and France are Canada's biggest markets for tourism and for cultural tourism. And so they were not surprised or disappointed, but they were very happy with the results of the market feasibility, the fact that if they do build the campground, if they structure it a certain way, people will come.
Thank you very much, Kinga.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Kinga Uto, a master's student in the Department of Rural Economy at the University of Alberta. Her research, as well as that of Brock Simons, Piange J. Singe, and Eric Nielsen, was supported by the Sustainable Forest Management Network. They were on hand to talk about their posters and their research at the recent gathering of the Canadian Science Writers Association in Jasper. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair, Alberta Ingenuity, the University of Lethbridge, the Alberta Conservation Association, Science Alberta Foundation, and Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.